John M. from Louisville, Kentucky.
Well, good evening, everybody. My name's Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And I really am so grateful to be up here tonight. And gosh, this conference has got such a spirit or a personality to it. I believe for a long time that conferences do have a personality or a spirit, and this one is just wonderful. And I want to thank everybody that's been involved in it. Of course, Tom, as he said, has been my host. Now, he's told on me on the Little Debbie's thing, so I might as well abandon any hope of looking classy. And Jerry's over there nodding his head because he hosted me one time, and he had to make the run to 7-Eleven. of course, John is the one that called me a long time ago and asked me to be involved, and I love seeing him and his lovely wife, Kathy, and just thank everybody for what they've done here. And the signers, they are so, so important, and I want to thank you ladies for what you're doing here. And I want to thank Mike and his sweet lady and the whole crew for recording it for posterity. And so I think I've forgotten as few people as I can get by with. So we're going to go there. And I've got, by the way, this watch thing, as my friend Bob B. says, it's to give you hope. I'm going to need some divine intervention over the next few minutes here. And kind of you guys are too, because y'all on this trip with me. And by the way, if you are new and you are intellectually offended by some old fool up here talking about divine intervention, not only do I understand, you're sitting in my old seat. And I've got a suggestion for you. Just call it the magic from the steps, and it'll get you to the same place and won't offend your sensitive intellect so terribly. But by whatever name, we're going to need it. And the first place we're going to need it is to get Don Major, me, out of the way. I used to stand up to give an AA talk and say, if I can get me out of the way, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. If I could get me out, and my sobriety day, by the way, is April 9th of 1981, and I'm not a bit more capable, not a hair more capable of getting myself out of the way tonight than I was in April 1981. It's way too big a job for me. I've got to have some divine help. The second thing that we're going to need a lot of help on is I'm going to try to follow directions. And I've got a long and sad history with the directions. There's a little fellow inside me, and he and I are the world's greatest experts on everything. Whether we know anything about it or not, it's totally irrelevant. And this little guy and I are not only so well-informed, we are also really worldly and sophisticated. You know, we know how the world really works. For instance, we know who is always in charge of making up the directions. It's Square Johns, just button-down conservative Square Johns, and they're usually being advised by insurance lawyers who are worse than they are. And this little guy and I understand the target audience of the directions. It's always morons. They're always overstated to try to manipulate morons into doing something. And this will shock all of you that haven't known me for a while. My case is different. If you're new, that's a joke. but in my special case, it's always been necessary, I guess, to sort of extrapolate to figure out what the directions really mean, because they obviously didn't mean what they said. And I assure you that if I haven't done the work I need to do today, and if I've learned anything in 33 years around here, I've learned that I don't get a whole lot of divine intervention on Saturday based on what I did on Friday. If I haven't done what I need to do today to get my help, if I hear or see some directions that say something like, do not exceed 6 in 24 hours, my brain will actually register that as meaning something like, do not exceed 36 in 24 hours. So we're going to need help on the directions. The directions I hope to follow, the simple ones that we hear all the time with how it works, a little bit about what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. And there's another set of directions in the book that we don't talk about nearly as much. And that's where it says that our personal story is telling in our own language and from our own point of view, how we've been able to form a relationship with our Creator. And I really hope that my story carries that message, because when I was first exposed to AA, I was absolutely allergic to the God thing. I'm not talking about closed or dubious or skeptical. I'm talking about allergic. I can feel, can remember how it physically felt for the little hairs to raise up on the back of my neck when you guys talked about God and insulted my intelligence. So, and as far as you talking about higher power, you weren't kidding me. You were trying to backdoor me on that God crap. I think it made me madder. So the talk about God and higher power kept running me out the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of the ones that's been so, so blessed, because I was allowed to live and to get run back in here enough times by alcohol, because I didn't have anywhere else to go, that finally in April of 1981, a loving God that I didn't even know was there did something that I didn't know could be done. That loving God gave me the most beautiful gift I've ever had or I will ever get. And what that gift is the first tiny little bit of teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. The first willingness to follow some suggestions that were made about how to run my life, even though I didn't understand them, I didn't agree with them, and I didn't think they would work. And you know, every time I say that, all these years later, a part of my brain wants to raise its hand and say, what's wrong with that? Why should a halfway intelligent person do something about their life if they don't understand it or they don't agree with it or they don't think it'll work? When I get honest about it, in my case, it is really simple. You see, I've got a talking illness. My alcoholism has been running its mouth at me all my life. And my alcoholism is a mini splendored thing. It's got all sorts of facets to it. And it's a scary thing. I've nearly died from my alcoholism a number of times. I'll probably talk about one or two of them a little later on. But the scariest thing about my alcoholism is that it's never tried to kill me, even though I've nearly died from it so many times. And what's so terrifying about that is that my alcoholism doesn't care whether I live or die. And my alcoholism doesn't care whether you live or die. My alcoholism is the perfect sociopath. It's only got one reason for existing, and that's to try to get itself that next drink. And it'll tell me anything on the face of this earth in order to get it. It'll tell me totally inconsistent lies, back to back with one another, just sling it all up against the wall and hope somebody will stick. Well, after 33 years sober, I got to tell you, the crazy picture show is still rolling in the back of my head, and my alcoholism is still talking to me every day. Now, what has changed is that the great majority of the time, I can recognize that that's not reality and I don't have to obey it. In fact, as often as not, I can laugh at it, because I assure you some funny crap goes on the back of my head in that old crazy picture show. But the important part there is most of the time that I can recognize it. One of the facets of my alcoholism is something that if you've been around a month or you've listened to one of Clancy's K-tapes, you've certainly heard. And that is that it's a disorder of my perception. Well, you know, that's kind of a nice academic sounding term. Gee, I have a disorder of my perception. But I'm going to look that up. All in the world that means is I don't see things right. I don't hear them right. I don't always recognize them for what they are. So the bottom line is really simple for me. With the incurable, progressive, and fatal thing that I've got wrong with me, when I put the final veto in this universe in my little old brain that I'm not going to do it unless I understand it and I agree with it and I think it'll work, with what I've got wrong with me, I have just put myself under death sentence. And I stay under death sentence until I get that veto out of my brain. I grew up on a tobacco farm in southwestern Kentucky, down on the Kentucky-Tennessee line. And probably the most informative thing I can tell you about my early life and childhood is that it wasn't a thing like I thought it was. Just absolutely no resemblance. My capacity for self-delusion is astounding. And if I haven't done the work I need to do today, that capacity for self-delusion is fully intact. I'm every bit as capable of it. It looks different than it did when 33 years ago, but it's still self-delusion nonetheless. And I was 37 when I got sober. I know it's hard to believe I was ever 37 now, but I really was. And until Till I got sober, I would have passed any lie detector test on earth. When I told you the riveting, interesting, and romantic saga, it was way past a mere story, of my early struggles and my subsequent rise to power. And, of course, it was all about how by my iron will and my sterling intellect, I had pulled myself up by the bootstraps from the depths of poverty to those staggering heights I'd reached in life. And I believed that crap so sincerely, I'd have you and me both crying before I was halfway done telling it. And I wasn't sober a week when I realized, man, it was a load of crap, because we weren't even poor to start with. We weren't anywhere close to poor. We were middle-class farming people that had everything we needed and most of the things we wanted. And those staggering heights I thought I'd reach, they were a whole lot more staggering than they were high. Another facet of my many-splendored thing is something that my high school English teacher would probably have called a disease of superlatives. And what that means is that without divine intervention, I won't think in terms of things like good and bad. And ordinary won't ever cross my mind. I'll go directly to the extremes of everything, best, worst, big deals on both sides of the deal. Truth is, drunk and sober, I've been a whole lot more ordinary than my ego has ever been comfortable with. But what was really going on with me the first 12, 13 years of my life wasn't anything like that interesting and romantic stuff I thought was going on. The big book says that selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, are the root of our troubles. And what that's meant to me for a long, long time is that the first thing wrong with me is that I've got a disorder of my ego. And I've had it all of my life, as far back as I can remember, way before I ever took a drink. And on account of that disorder of my ego, without something to change it, for the last 33 years, the only thing that's changed it has been the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and you folks. Without something to change that disordered ego, it makes me so obsessed with myself, so obsessed with how I believe I stack up against other people in this world, so obsessed with how I feel, that for many years now, I have boiled the bedrock of my alcoholism where I believe it absolutely starts down to one sentence. And I believe it's valid in my case. I don't know about anybody else's. But what that one sentence is this. Without divine intervention, I will always wind up letting how I feel be the most important thing in the world. Now, without divine intervention, I may be able to give some lip service to something being more important than how I feel. And I might be able to act for just a little while like something's more important than how I feel. But if I haven't done the work I need to do to get my magic from the steps, my divine intervention, that's all a smokescreen. When the chips get down, I'll go right back to my default position. And my default position is to let how I feel be the most important thing in this universe. And another thing that obsession with myself has always done, it's always created so much pain and emptiness down inside me that I've never been able to stand the way I feel inside without either running as hard as I can run and or stuffing everything in there and fine to try to keep you from looking and seeing what is going on, what I am and what I am not. Because if you see, then I guess a part of me knew I'd have to look at it and be like the earth would swallow me up through that emptiness in my own belly. So what was really going on that first 12 or 13 years was a totally self-obsessed kid trying to stay a half step ahead of a screaming fit. juggling everything, trying to keep all the balls in the air and the mirrors working, the bells ringing, the lights flashing, smoke shooting out so that you couldn't see and I didn't have to look at what I was and what I wasn't. And that ego disorder has dominated my entire life. If I don't do what I need to do today to get past it, it'll dominate it today. And some of the things it's done have right amusing, or at least they've got an amusing aspect to them. One thing is, it has always made me an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And what I mean by that is I've always been perfectly capable of feeling too good for something or somebody, at the same instant knowing I wasn't nearly good enough for that same person or that same thing. I've always known that I could do anything. And at the same time, I've always known that I couldn't really do anything. And so that's been rattling around up there for 70 years, and I guess it doesn't bother me sometimes much. But one of the things that it does, if I haven't done what I need to do to get my divine intervention, I can't be okay with anything or anybody on the face of this earth. I cannot be on your level. I can be above you. I can be below you. And insanely, I can be both at the same time. But I'm all alone. I have no peers. I'm not okay with anything or anybody on the face of this earth. And that's the mess that I brought to my first drunk when I was either 12 or 13 years old. And that first night I got in a lot of trouble, and I puked, and I blacked out, and I passed out, and I woke up the next morning and had an awful, terrible hangover. And I swore that those Baptists around there were right, and that I would never, ever do that again. And not only was I sincere, it was fairly effective, because it was nearly a week until I got drunk the second time. And that's no mystery to me now. I got drunk that second time after all the pain and trouble I had the first time for exactly the same reason I got drunk the other few thousand times. You see, when I got enough of that booze in me for the first time in my life, I had found something that filled up that emptiness, that did something about that pain inside me, and I didn't have to run. I didn't have to try to stuff anything else in there. It was what I'd been looking for, a little peace and feeling okay inside. And I was okay with you. I was okay with the world. I was okay with everything. So my powerlessness over alcohol and the things like it doesn't hold any mystery for me. In fact, I think it's a no-brainer. I don't think in my case it could have been any other way. Because for the next 25 years, I didn't know that anything other than the booze and the things like it could make me feel the way I needed to feel. And remember that the way I feel is the most important thing in my universe without divine intervention, and I sure wasn't looking for any of that for the next 25 years. So the bottom line was real simple. It didn't matter what it cost, and it didn't matter who it cost, because it was the only thing that fixed the way I feel, and the way I feel was the most important thing in this universe. So school was easy. Well, let me tell you a little something about my drinking career. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on drunkalogue tonight, but I do want to let you know that I didn't come in here because it gave me the hiccups. and I am really, really acutely aware that part of our peculiar mental twist, and I put an S on the twist, although the book doesn't, part of my peculiar mental twist anyway, and I think most of us, it's at least as easy for us to exaggerate how bad we were as it is for us to exaggerate how great we are. But to the best of my recollection, here's what I can tell you about my drinking. From the first time I got drunk till I got sober 25 years later, I did not apologize for my drinking. I did not hide my drinking. I don't believe that I ever one time told myself or anybody else that I was just going to have a couple of drinks. I never wanted a couple of drinks. A couple of drinks never did anything to me except make me need something to drink really badly. For that 25 years, I'm convinced that I went to bed drunk 80% of the nights. I had no idea I was going to be a drunk that often, because the only standard I had for whether or not I was drunk was whether or not I remembered everything. If I remembered everything, didn't black out, I was not drunk. That conversation was over. The fact is, now that Kentucky, where I live, has got that blood alcohol limit down to 0.08, I probably woke up drunk 80% of the mornings. And sadly, one thing that always went on with the alcoholism was that everybody that was in my life, in any capacity whatsoever, always wound up blowing the whistle on my drinking. They always wound up saying something like, "Don, we need to talk about your drinking, the way you live. Because you're a nice guy most of the time, and it gets exciting around you from time to time, too. But there's something wrong. There's something wrong with the way you drink, and there's something wrong with the way you live." And what I probably said was, "Oh, what a relief. I'm so glad you brought that up. We do need to talk about it." The reality was that if I couldn't change your position, you had just punched your ticket out of my life. And it didn't matter how much I cared for you, how much I needed you, how much, as best I could, I loved you. if you were going to mess with the only thing that made me feel the way I needed to feel, and the way I feel is the most important thing in the world, you had to go. And I'm not laughing about this. I've had to do a lot of amends on account of it, and I think it's a pretty fair partial description of a sociopath. But for about the last 20 years that I drank, and I had figured that out, that everybody was going to blow the whistle by the time I was 15 years old. For roughly the last 20 years that I drank, I don't believe I had people in my life. I had positions. And whatever your position was, I probably had your replacement interviewed at any given time. Because I knew you were going to blow the whistle on me and I'd have to get rid of you. School was really easy for me. And let me say this. It was a different world in Trigg County, Kentucky in the 1950s than today's world. A kid in today's world who drank the way I drank and acted the way I acted would have his little butt thrown in an asylum with a net over him before his 14th birthday. But in Trigg County, Kentucky in the 1950s, if you were cute enough and you were smart enough, and very importantly, if you had the right last name, you could get away with murder. And I figuratively did that. But I finished my junior year of high school and I was 16 years old and I was still holding on to everything by my fingernails. But I was holding on to it. I was keeping it juggled. But I knew it was about to all come tumbling down and I knew it was on account of my drinking. Didn't have a bit of denial about it. Knew that what it was. So I knew on one hand that it was time for me to get out of Dodge before everything collapsed on my head. And then the egomania part was assuring me that tobacco patch couldn't hold something as hot as I was anyway. So I got on a Greyhound bus by myself and went 200 miles up to the big city of Louisville, Kentucky. And I kicked around for a couple of days and I wound up on the doorstep of the University of Louisville. And they gave me a bunch of tests and let me in as an early admission student with an academic scholarship. And my reaction to that was to stay so drunk the first semester that I lost all concept of day and night. It was just a matter of passing out and coming to. And of course, I blew the scholarship. And then for the next 7.5 years, I worked full-time, drank full-time, went to school full-time, and somehow finished undergraduate in law school, and I've got no idea how that happened. When I look back on it, that whole 8 years is just a swirling gray mass of alcoholic insanity. I don't have a handful of real crisp, clear memories that I can tell you about that entire 8 year period. The spring of 1968, I graduated from law school and my daughter Dana, bless her heart, was born. Dana's 46 now. And she was my only child for over 20 years. I've got a 25-year-old son now, but Dana was the only chick for a long, long time. And I started practicing law in downtown Louisville in 1968. And I practiced for about 10 years with a fairly good bit of material success. That's another part of our peculiar mental twist. I wasn't nearly as successful as I thought I was when I was a few years sober. Our past gets a different focus on it as we stay sober longer. But I've always been a criminal defense lawyer, and I've always had a knack for getting involved in some cases from time to time that had some money in them and sometimes some publicity. And that's what I would stick in your face when you suggested that there was something wrong with somebody who lived as insanely as I did. Now, I've already told you how I lived the 8 years prior to beginning to practice law. It escalated. It escalated because everybody that's ever had alcoholism, it progresses. And it escalated because I had a little money to escalate it with. And during that 10 years, I used a world of things other than the booze and a world of them. But before you get your singly superb for Snickers in a knot, let me explain to you. And hey, I'm all for singly superb. I really am. But I was just like Bill and Dr. Bob. You'd read their stories in the same way. Everything else was a sideshow for me. The booze was the big tent. Everything else was something to change the effect of the booze, maybe increase the effect, maybe decrease the effect, maybe help me try to function on the hangovers. But the booze was what it always all went back to with me, despite the volume of other things that I did. February 10th of 1978, I'd been practicing law for almost 10 years. That was a Friday. I got full of vodka, scotch, and three or four other very powerful substances. And I drove a Corvette off the Pennyrow Parkway on the Kentucky-Tennessee line at somewhere between 120 and 130 miles an hour. Now, since the roads were icy, that was probably questionable judgment on my part. And that wreck did an awful lot of bad things to me. That wreck crushed both knees. I lost part of the main artery in one lower leg, and they had to do a bypass in the upper leg and take out a vein to graft it in to replace that artery, and separated my pelvis and severed my internal plumbing so that I didn't have a urinary function for over a year. I had what they call a suprapubic catheter, which is just a plastic tube with a flange on it where they bore a hole in your abdomen, pop that into your bladder to carry your urine out to a bag. And the first year after that wreck, I was in the hospital total for more than 6 months, and I had a half dozen major surgeries or so. The doctors told me early on that I would never be able to walk without at least a brace on one leg. And they were absolutely positive, no hope, that any surgeon would ever attempt to find the ends of my plumbing in there and somehow put it together so that I would be restored to a urinary function. Purely by the grace of God, because we know I wasn't following directions, right? Purely by the grace of God, I've been sober 33 years, and I haven't owned a brace for over 34 years. And about a year after that wreck, the head of urology down at Duke University did, in fact, put my plumbing back together and restore my urinary function. But I didn't know that was going to happen. And they took me to Nashville, Tennessee, to Vanderbilt Hospital right after that wreck, because I was a lot closer to Nashville than I was to Louisville when I had the wreck. And they didn't know who I was down there. They didn't treat me with nearly the appropriate deference, just not nearly. And as soon as I was able, I got out of intensive care for a long enough stretch to get myself, against medical advice, moved. I did. I got myself moved by ambulance 6 or 7 weeks into it back to Louisville. Let me tell you this about the wreck. At the time of the wreck, I was remarried to my daughter's mother, and I had a lady with me who was not my daughter's mother. Now, over the years, I have made an observation. I'm going to share it with you guys tonight, but please feel free to ignore it. It's not in the big book, and I promise it's the only sociological observation I'm going to make tonight. Over the years, I've looked back at that, and I have decided that the fact that I was remarried to the same woman probably establishes my alcoholism without further authentication. I just don't believe normies do that. You know, I believe if a normie even considered jumping right back in a frying pan that they just got out of, they'd tear the door off the asylum to protect themselves, and we do it routinely, drunk and sober. You know, old Joe and Sue had divorced, but they had dated, and they'll probably get back together. And it works for us sometimes. It's not necessarily bad. It's just really, really different from ordinary people. And by the way, I've had to make a lot of amends because of that boy-girl aspect of my life, and I'm not proud of it, but I'm not going to fail to laugh at myself where I have been ridiculous. And I have a memory of at Vanderbilt, sometime in the first few days of coming in and out of consciousness, and somebody dressed in white, I don't know their gender, don't know whether they were doctor, nurse, orderly, or Joe Blow, but I remember asking them, is my wife here? And I swear to God, they said, I'm afraid so, Mr. Major. And of course, I got a brand new divorce right after that wreck. Now, I didn't go broke right away. And let me tell you this, after I got back to Louisville, every single day, and I've checked it, a couple of guys are still alive in NAA, and I'm sponsoring them. They're my friends that I'm getting ready to talk about. Most of them are dead. A couple in the penitentiary doing essentially life in the penitentiary, but most are dead. And every single day that I laid in the Louisville hospital for months, my friends came in and brought me booze and more dope than the doctors were giving me. And I would lay in that hospital bed and I would say really intelligent things. I would say things like, you know, fellas, anybody can quit drinking when the going gets a little tough. But it takes a man to lay in there with it when the bills start coming in. And I would explain to him that a man ought not be out there doing the crime if he's not prepared to do the time. And just because we'd hit a little bump in the road, we weren't going to hear me whining. Let's have another drink and go on with it. That's insanity. That's powerlessness. And when you really think about it, it is absolutely letting how I feel in that moment be the most important thing in the universe. Letting how I feel in that moment be more important than my child. Letting how I feel being more important than my profession. Letting how I feel being more important than whether I ever walked. Letting how I feel be more important than whether I ever peed. Letting how I feel be more important than really whether I lived or died. letting how I feel in that moment be the most important thing in this universe. And it didn't go broke right away after that wreck. A little law firm, a few lawyers had built up around this other guy and myself, so some money came in for a while. And I wound up married to the young lady who was with me when I had the wreck. She had a seatbelt on, so she was not hurt as badly as I had. She was hurt pretty badly. Wound up married her during that period. And about a year after that wreck, sometime around the first year of 1979, I made my first trip to the asylum. And I don't use the word asylum to be cutesy. Bill Wilson uses that word in the book. Some of my places were called psychiatric hospitals. Some of them were called treatment centers, or some version of treatment centers. But I made my first one around the first year of 79. And by that time, I still had the tube in my belly and the catheter bag and the braces on both legs and the crutches. And the phenomenon of craving that the doctor's opinion talks about had progressed in me by that time. The physical allergy had progressed to me by that time to the point where I had just physically lost the ability to stop drinking ethyl alcohol when I got it in my body. Drunk and sober, I've had 14 or 15 major surgeries in my life, in fact, a couple of them in the last year and a half. And I want to tell you that nothing about any of those surgeries has ever hurt me nearly as bad physically as each one of the last couple of hundred times I had come off ethyl alcohol. Most nightmarish thing I've ever been through in my life, the most addictive thing, the most destructive thing I ever put in my body. After something did intervene and prize me loose from alcohol, it took 3 or 4 days for me to be physically able to do something like set up in a chair. And I sometimes say, if you were progressed that far the last time you checked on it, I don't need to explain that. If you weren't progressed that far the last time you checked on it, I'd be wasting my breath to describe it to you. But at any rate, they got me through the 3 or 4 days, and they set me up in a chair, and they had an AA meeting for some strange reason. And somebody got up there, and I know now that what they were doing was reading step 3, but at the time, it was clear to me, they were talking some mythical, malarkey, metaphysical crap about turning my will and life over to some godlike intelligence thing they were talking about. Of course, that insulted my intelligence terribly, so I climbed up on my crutches, straightened up my catheter bag, and said as loud as I could, "Do you mean to tell me there are people in this world who believe such crap?" And then I hobbled on over to the telepayphone and called somebody to come get me from those religious fanatics before they polluted my pristine intellect. And that was sometime around the first of the year of 1979. And I got sober almost 2.5 years later in April of 81. And I really don't remember much of what happened in that 2.5 years. But some of the things that I do know happened are that I went back to the asylum 17 more times. I became addicted to some substances that brought an awful lot of pressure, social and legal, on my law partners. Brought enough pressure on them to cause them to kick me out of the law firm that I had founded. And I'm so grateful for that, because I proved that I wasn't going to hit bottom. And by the way, if you're new, please don't sit around waiting for bottom to happen to you. I've seen so many people die waiting for bottom to happen to them. I don't believe bottom happens to us. I believe bottom is a decision. And we've got all the control in the world over it. When we decide that, yeah, I'm on this elevator that's going to the basement, it can't go anywhere other than there, but if I'll take my hand and reach out and push that button, I can get off on any floor I want to. Bad thing is, our families, the medical profession, the folks in AA can't push that button for us. And it seems like the loving God we talk about in here won't push that button for us. By the way, if there's anything else I've learned in the last 33 years, I've learned that my loving God will do almost anything for me. But I've also learned that my loving God will do almost nothing for me without my cooperation. I have to cooperate with him. But at any rate, decisions for me are always the same decision on hitting bottom, and I think I've hit bottom on something every 10 days for 33 years. And it's always the same decision. I mentioned earlier today the word decision is an important word to me. I had thought all my life that when I had formed an intention, I had made a decision. And I've learned a great truth, and that truth is that I don't make decisions with my brain. I just think I do. I make decisions with my feet. I form intentions with my brain. And it's so helpful to me. Through the years, it has been so helpful to be careful not to misname an intention as a decision until it's graduated to being a decision by me beginning to take the action on it. And I proved where I was being grateful that the guys about the addiction that caused the guys to kick me out of the law firm that I'd founded. I proved that I wasn't going to make that decision as long as I had a Timex watch. I sure wasn't going to do it as long as I had a law firm. And shortly after the guys kicked me out of the law firm, the state of Kentucky jerked my law license. We had built an office building in downtown Louisville, and the Internal Revenue took my portion of that and some things like that. My new wife had to leave me on account of my insanity, and during that period, she was staying with some girlfriends and died in an accident. I last laid eyes on my daughter Dana in January of 1980, and I didn't see or talk to Dana again for over 3 years. And for almost a year up until the fall of 1980, I lived without an address on what I called the street and an expired Blue Cross Blue Shield card. In the fall of 1980, I washed up on the doorstep of asylum number 17, the next to last one. It was back in Nashville, Tennessee. And the fellow that was financially in charge of that place told me later, Harold had been dead for years, but he said the only reason he let me in, because he certainly knew they weren't going to get paid anything for me, the only reason he let me in is he did not think I would live another week if he'd left me on the street. I had no home, I had no car, I had no clothing, my teeth were rotting out of my head. They kept me in there a little more than 30 days because they kept taking me out of medical detox and taking a look at me and putting my butt back in medical detox. So I had something a little over 30 days, they had to let me out. I had no place to go. I had no way to get there. And I had a real young guy that was my roommate there. Of course, I was aging. I was 35 or 36, and Matt was 21. And his family lived in Nashville. And those sweet spiritual folks really weren't all that much involved in AA. They were just sweet, kind, spiritual folks. And they felt sorry for me and said, Don, why don't you come stay with us a few days, and let's try to figure out what to do with you. I went and lived with them a year. And the first 6 months, I didn't stay straight. But I got better. And I think I had to get better before I could grasp recovery or anything else. For some reason, to me, it just kind of sums it up. When I was a couple of months sober, I'm talking about a couple of months after April 9th, 1981, I had not regained the ability to use a knife and fork on food correctly. And I guess I was just embarrassed to ask anybody else. We'd go to a meeting at the 202 Club in Nashville every night, and then we'd go down the street to the Shoney's restaurant. I would sit there with a knife and fork under the table watching my friends use that knife and fork because I guess I was just embarrassed to say, excuse me, Jimmy boy, I seem to have lost this ability. Can you give me a little hint on how to use it? So I needed to get better, and I did get better. During that six-month period, from the fall of 80 until April of 81, I went to a world of AA meetings, most of them at that 202 Club there in Nashville. I got to where sometimes I could go 2 or 3 weeks without getting ripped, and that was a world record for me, in or out of the asylum. I was a master at getting ripped in the asylum. And how I really know I got better is that in that whole six-month period, they only put me back in the asylum one time. At the rate I'd be going, twice a year in the asylum looked like the picture of mental health. Late March of 1981, I began my most recent drunk. And during that drunk, it was one of my pop-off vodka / Listerine drunks. And this is not a joke. I honestly have better memories of the Listerine than I do of that old hot pop-off. I can stand to smell Listerine today, but I can't stand to smell the pop-off. But on this most recent drunk, I was drinking and taking everything I could get my hands on. By the time April the 8th of 81 rolled around, I'd been drunk 10 days or 2 weeks, and I was sitting on the edge of a bed in a motel in Nashville, and a loving God gave me some gifts. And I had no idea I had any gifts. I didn't see a burning bush. I didn't feel any different. I didn't have any feeling, oh, this is a different. Scales have fallen from my eyes. None of it. I still felt too special and intelligent and complex for this silly program to work on me. I still felt too bad and disillusioned to think that I could ever get sober or anything, because I had a lot of reason to believe that if I did get sober, the end of that might just be to spend the rest of my life in the penitentiary or get shot, blown in two by a sawed-off shotgun. So my illness is telling me, you're too good for it to work, Don. You're too bad for it to work. You're too good. You're too bad. And I was believing it both times. I didn't know. But at any rate, the gift that my loving God had given me was that first little bit of teachability, humility that I mentioned earlier. And I had no idea. I had it. Nothing was different. 3 or 4 days after that most recent drink, I stumbled back to the door of the 202 Club in Nashville. And in today's world, they would not let me back in that club because I had passed out in their AA meetings and had to be bodily carried out. They had caught me with illegal matters in their men's room. They had warned the people that they sponsored to stay away from me, that I was a loser and I was going to die. About 2 months before I got sober, I was walking through the 202 Club, and a big old boy who's been dead several years by the name of Joe Wall. Joe walked up and looked down at me and said, "Don, I'm beginning to think that you really are too intelligent for this deal." And I thought he was giving me a compliment. My knee-jerk was, well, thank goodness they finally figured out who they're dealing with here. But Joe went on, and I'm so grateful he did. And he said, "And you know, Don, that's a real shame, because we have never had anybody too dumb for this deal, and we bury you buttholes all time." And that felt like an icy hand closing over something inside me. And it was still there 2 months later when I stumbled back to that door, and they did let me in. I remember what was said and who said it. They said, "Come on in, Don. You're keeping us sober." And I said, "Well, y'all tell me one more time what I need to do if I want to live." And they said, "Sure, don't drink, don't take dope, go to meetings." By the grace of God, that first 60 days, I went to over 150 meetings. To the best of my recollection, I didn't want to go to one of them. I'm sure after I got feeling better physically, I was hoping I'd see some woman or something that I intended to see. But as far as going to any one of those meetings for the right reason, to the best of my memory, I didn't. My brain was still assuring me that what we needed to do was get our head out of the sand, get our butt back to Louisville, get some money, a law license, big car, good-looking woman, be somebody, for heaven's sake. But I've been given that beautiful gift that I didn't know I had, of being able to turn around in my brain and say, "Yeah, I know, partner, but you and I have nearly killed one another, and we don't have anything left to do but go to these dumb old meetings, even though they can't possibly work in our complex situation." And thank my loving God, I had the same thing backwards there that I have always had backwards if I haven't done what I need to do to get my divine intervention. Now, I still have backwards if I haven't done my work to get it. I make it all about what I think, feel, and believe. In nature, it doesn't occur to me, if I don't feel like doing right, to go ahead and do it anyway. In nature, every fiber of my being wants to work on me and get you to help me working on me to fix me inside so I feel like doing right. If I don't feel like going to work, I want to call up one and say, "Jerry, I don't feel like going to work. Reckon I ought to do an inventory on that or something, or maybe I get some outside counseling. I got to go to work. What difference make whether I feel like going to work or not?" But I didn't know I'd been given that gift. And it turned out, see, I thought that for AA to work, that first I had to believe it would work. I thought that was the price of admission. First I had to believe it would work. And then I thought, certainly, that it had to feel like it was working in the process while it was working. And I think I also believed that I needed to be able to see the causal relationship of A causing B. It turned out none of that had anything to do with it. All I needed to do was get my raggedy butt to meeting after meeting and let my old sick brain and soul get dragged in there kicking and screaming behind the raggedy butt. And then they told me if we want to live, I was going to have to read the big book. I said, "I've read it several times," and they said, "We know. You've been quoting it to us and criticizing the literary style while you've been dying." I said, "The first thing you need to understand, Don, is the big book is not the solution to your alcoholism." And I said, "You've been telling me for nearly 3 years that the big book is the solution to my alcoholism." They said, "No, we haven't." They said, "We know you've been hearing that, but what we've been telling you is that the action described in the big book is the solution to your alcoholism. They said, this is not a philosophy book. There's nothing here you can learn or master that's going to transport you to some sort of sublime state of sobriety. And they said, also, don't believe this crap about recovery being mainly a learning process. They said, you got to learn about that much. And they said, Don, in your case, you've had enough information for over 2 years about recovery in AA to stay sober a day at a time the rest of your life without learning one single new piece of information. What's killing you isn't what you know and don't know, dummy. It's what you're doing and not doing. And they said, if you want to live, you better come back to that book like a little child and try to act like you've never laid eyes on it before. And start at the front cover and go through it line for line, reading only the black part. Not memorizing, arguing with, or distinguishing anything, not even looking for something to learn, but looking for what it says do. They explain this big book is not a philosophy book, it's a simple instruction manual for your actions. And if you want to live with what you've got wrong with you, you better take those actions. That was about the time that they explained to me that the steps, the 12 steps, are the only program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing else in the first 164 pages that's called a program of recovery. They explained that I can grab hold of this fellowship, and thank goodness there's no requirement for membership in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous other than a desire not to drink or a desire to stop drinking. It doesn't even have to be an honest desire anymore. It'd be a halfway desire to stop drinking. And thank God there's no other requirement other than that. But they explained that I can be going to 10 meetings a week, talking the best recovery you ever heard. And if I'm not somewhere in the process of doing steps 1 through 9, the way the book says, in order to reach a state of recovery, or having done that, I'm living every day doing that work that is the maintenance of my spiritual condition in order to get my daily reprieve and keep my recovery. If I'm not somewhere in that process, I may indeed be a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm not in the program of AA. And I'm not in a program of recovery. And I will have no healing, regardless of how long I manage to stay dry, about that disordered ego, that inability to be comfortable inside myself, that inability to be okay with you or anybody on the face of this earth. The only help I'm going to get from that is from doing those steps the way the book says do them. That's when they explain that the steps are the prescription for alcoholism. They explain that they work on alcoholism exactly like penicillin works on infection. They explain that if I've got an infection that's going to kill me if it's not treated, but it will respond to penicillin, I don't need to understand the origin, width, breadth, and nature of my infection. And I don't need to aggravate my family and the medical profession's own whining about that. I don't need to understand one single thing about how penicillin works in the human body. I don't need to understand how penicillin works in the human body. I don't need to believe that they will do the job. And here's the real kicker. I don't need to want to take the pills. Whether or not I want to take the pills is irrelevant. If I take the pills as directed, whether I wanted to or not, I'm going to be okay and just fine. If I don't, I'm going to die. And these steps have indeed worked exactly that way on me. And I've been so blessed over the years to see it work that way in dozens, even hundreds of other people's lives. Then they told me if I want to live, I was going to have to get on my knees every morning and every night and ask and thank a power greater than myself. And the tears came rolling down my cheeks. And I was explaining to him, in good faith, I was telling the truth. Because, you see, I had zero denial. I had known for a long, long time by that time that any outside chance I had of living, I was going to have to get this thing that you guys had. And I thought in order to get it, I was going to have to somehow change what I thought, felt, and believed to make it more like it looked like to me you thought, felt, and believed. And I honestly had tried in good faith every way I knew how for over 2 years. I had tried every way I knew to find switches and toggles and buttons inside myself to change what I thought, felt, and believed, and I couldn't change a hair, absolutely nothing. So I'm telling them that, explaining to them really that the second step is killing me, with the tears running down my cheeks, when they said, and thank God I heard them this time, I'm sure they'd said it 1,000 times or so earlier, when they said, oh, Don, you've got that backwards too. We have never suggested that you think, feel, or believe anything. They said, the first, my mouth probably fell open because I think that's the whole deal, you know. They said, no, I said, in the first place, you are far too ill to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs whatsoever. And they said, in the second place, the issue of whether you live or die is going to be determined solely by what you do. What you think, feel, and believe won't have a thing to do with it. So I said, if you want to live, you get down on your knees and say those words and don't worry about the crazy picture show in the back of your head. It won't count. Well, sometime in the latter part of April of 81, over my brain's loud veto, 100% acting as if, embarrassed even though I was by myself, I started getting on my knees every morning and every night and asking and thanking something that I didn't think was there to do something that I didn't think could be done. And the miracle of the second step began to happen to me. Bill describes guys like me, not in the big group, but in the 12 and 12 in the second step. You see, if I'd waited until I intellectually really believed that second step, that there was a power greater than myself that could take care of this humanly impossible mess that I've admitted I'm in if I've done step one correctly, if I'd had to wait until I intellectually believed that, I would have been rotting in a pauper's grave after having died a mad dog death more than 33 years ago. It turned out that when I became willing to act like a person would act, if they did believe that, it was absolutely sufficient. And the reality of belief followed that action. I lived in Nashville 21 months after I got sober. When I celebrated a year sober, I was living in an attic by that time. I was out for not living longer with the sweet family. I still had no car. I didn't have any telephone. I was unemployed and unemployable. I was living week to week, half hand to mouth, getting money however I could. And I was happier than I'd ever been in my life. At about a year and a half, they finally got me by the third step, finally got it through my head that it doesn't turn anything over to God at all. That it's merely a decision to set out on a track, which means, number one, I'm deciding to do the rest of the steps. And I'm deciding that when what I want to do conflicts with what I know in my heart is the right thing to do, I'm going to try to do the right thing. And they finally got it through my head that if I'll do that, God will make my will in life what it's supposed to be. That the third step is merely going in a room with an understanding person, getting on my knees and saying that third step prayer, and begin getting up and then beginning to walk that way. And by the way, the bill is very clear that the wording of the third step prayer is quite optional as long as we kept the main idea. Let me give you my comment on that right quick. Bill was being diplomatic. It's exactly what he was being, because all of them that were involved in writing that book, they figured out that you couldn't impress alcoholics by telling them, you have to do this, you must do that. That's why it's written, we this and suggestion that and so on. And the book would probably have flopped if it had not been written that way. But what would be the sense in me trying to use a brain that has destroyed everything in my life to improve on the third step prayer? What kind of insanity would that be? But at any rate, I did that, and they led me through steps 4 and 5. I did that and formed a picture of what a spiritual dawn ought to look like. And I went back to my attic after I'd done my fifth step, and I got my big book down. Just like it says, I spent 1 hour reviewing steps 1 through 5, decided I'd done okay on that. And I thought 6 and 7 were where, with God's help, I'd gotten that far. I went to work on me to make me into what I'd decided a spiritual dawn ought to be. So I said the seventh step prayer, and I went on about my business, moving on with the steps. At about a year and a half sober, as a pure byproduct of steps 8 and 9, my law license got put back in order. I didn't think that would happen, didn't even really particularly want it to happen. I'm absolutely sure that if I had had that as an objective, not only would I not have gotten a law license back, I think I would have been dead from alcoholism many, many years ago. When I became willing to act like a fellow would act, if he was unconcerned with those things and was concerned only with literally doing what the steps required, that's when the magic started happening for me. I went back to Louisville, 21 months sober, scared to death. I didn't think that Louisville AA would be as good as Nashville, but I threw myself into Louisville AA, and it wasn't a month before I thought it might be better. The second month that I was in town, in February of 1983, Don Pritz got snowed in at an airport out west. He was supposed to be the Sunday morning speaker at the Kentucky State Convention. It was a lot bigger then than it is now. It was 2,000 people were there. So Don got snowed in and couldn't get there by Sunday morning, and the host committee got the bright idea to put me up there in front of 2,000 people, 22 months sober, and they did. And I thought that was terrible, but my judgment of events in my life always sucks. If I think it has no redeeming qualities, if I manage not to drink and keep on stumbling, it will wind up being the basis of some of the most beautiful things in my life. And when I first see it, if I think this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, it's probably getting ready to try to kill me. And by the way, as far as ideas trying to kill me, I have never had a crazy idea walk up to me and say, "Good morning, Don, I'm a crazy idea and I'm here to kill you." They always come the same way. They say, "Good morning, buddy, I'm common sense." You know, if those folks were in your special situation with all the pressures on them, they'd do it that way too. Probably a lot of them doing it that way and just won't admit it. You know, on and on, telling me it's common sense. So I have to always keep an eye out for that insane idea coming to me as common sense. But at any rate, things were going great in a lot of ways. When I started getting on my knees in April of 81, I've never stopped on that. There have only been a few days when I was in the hospital and physically could not get out from surgery. In the last 24 years, my sweet wife Sharon has knelt down by my bed and held my hand, and we've done it that way. So other than that, I haven't missed a morning or night getting on my knees. But I'm not telling you that to tell you how great I am. I'm telling you that for what I think is a far more important reason. In all those thousands of mornings and nights that I've gotten down there, at least half the time I haven't really wanted to. A big part of the time I could have gotten a written medical excuse that I did not feel like getting down there. More often than not, I could have gotten affidavits from lawyers and judges that I didn't have time to get down there. And a big bunch of the time, my old brain's spinning, I'm so scared, you know, and obsessed with something that it seems like I can't remember the last word I just tried to pray. And it seems clear to me the words are bouncing off the walls and ceiling. It couldn't possibly do any good. But I've gotten down there every morning and night, and something's worked every single day. So I don't plan to stop it. And I tell the guys I sponsor, say, "Hey, you know, I don't dictate anything. You pray however you want to. But don't ask me for any hints on how to stay sober without getting on your knees every morning and every night, because I don't have one day's experience in that. The only experience I have with staying sober is getting on my knees every morning and every night." But that same month, by the way, that I talked at that conference, I saw Dana, my daughter, for the first time in over 3 years. And 2 months after that, she moved in with me and lived with me all through her high school years. And she and I have been dear friends and had a great relationship for all these years since then. In fact, in 2010, I got asked to go to Russia and Kiev and the Ukraine and do the steps to an interpreter. And Dana, my daughter, is fluent in Russian. She's got a faculty for language. It just makes me want to strangle her, as I envy it so badly. But at her own expense, she went along. She's been in Al-Anon over 30 years and did the Al-Anon part without an interpreter, and that was just a wonderful, great trip. But at any rate, I had Dana back, and first thing you know, I was making a little money practicing law, and after speaking at that conference, people started saying really nice things to me. "Don, will you speak here? Will you do this? Will you be my sponsor?" and so on. All these great things were happening in the South. We're driving a decent car, wearing decent clothes, and the first 9 years of my sobriety were just enchanted. They really were. They were just absolutely beyond belief. It's humanly impossible for anybody that was where I was in April of 1981 to have 9 years in their life that were like that first 9 years of my sobriety. But as wonderful as they were, relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos like to have killed me during that 9 years. And I worked at them so hard. Whatever was making me uncomfortable, whatever character defect that I needed gone because this picture I had of what a spiritual Don ought to be, I would grab it by the collar. I would use steps, prayer, outside counseling, sponsors, inventories. I'd slam that thing up against the wall and say, "Come here, God, and give me a little help." God never came one single time. And I didn't know what was wrong. And some things happened in May of 1990 when I was 9 years sober. Cherry Carpenter, my original sponsor, had died. And I'd asked Tom B. from right outside of Cleveland, Ohio, Tom to be a sponsor. He still is today. And I flew to Cleveland, spent a weekend in Cleveland. And that things happened that weekend that caused me to look at Step 6 and 7 in an entirely different way. Another word that's really important to me is the word realize. I thought all my life that to know something and to realize it is the same thing. But realize is a form of the word real. When I have realized something, that literally means that it has been brought to reality inside me. Whole different animal from intellectually knowing it. whole lots of things that I've known for 30 years that I have not realized, that I have not become real inside me. I could have quoted the seven-step prayer backwards to you. If you'd given me a few minutes and let me sit down at a table, I could start at the last word and going back to the first word. It wasn't a matter of not knowing what the word said. It was a matter of not realizing that it really meant what it said, that it doesn't ask God to remove all my defects of character. It asks God only to remove the ones that stand in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows, and I don't know which ones they are. And it turned out that it isn't where I go to work on my character defects with God's help. It's where I quit working on my character defects. It's where I give up, where I surrender just like I had to surrender to booze. And I say, God, Mom, Dad, I don't know even where we are or where we're supposed to get to. And I've made such a mess of trying to figure out the patterns of my life so I'll know where to start stitching. And it turns out that I've got less ability to understand the patterns in my life than a chimpanzee does to master quantum physics. And I believe that all of us have got a spark of the divine in us that knows only God's will for right now. Not God's will for 5 seconds from now. You know, we think it'll be God's will 5 seconds from now to me be going on and your old bladder be about to give out on it. But the fact is that in the next 5 seconds, any one of us could have a heart attack or a seizure. The electricity could go off. Sprinkler system could go on. Wet drunk could come stumbling in here yelling, raising sand. Police could come in looking for one of us that hadn't completed our amends. All sorts of things. All sorts of things that could happen, would could happen to absolutely change what God's will would be 5 seconds from now. And yet I want to worry about God's will for tomorrow and next Tuesday and 5 years from now. What happened was that I started doing the best I could to lay it all at God's feet, and I was led to other steps that I'd already done. You know, it isn't just the sixth and seventh step that tell us that we don't do this for ourselves. They all tell us that. The third step says, take away my difficulties, not so I can be spiritual and happy and sober. It says, take away my difficulties that victory over them will bear witness to those I would help of God's love, power, and way of life. And then we've got steps 8 and 9. They are all about cleaning up our past, right? Yeah. Except on page 77, it says, yeah, we're doing that, but that's not our real purpose. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and those around us. Guys, I've got an illness that is self-centeredness. I can't effectively treat it by more obsession on myself. It doesn't make any difference how I dress it up. And I've got an entire wardrobe for self-centeredness. There's self-obsession. I can dress it up in psychological clothing. I can dress it up in responsibility clothing. I can dress it up in spiritual clothing and call it something other than self-obsession, but it's still like trying to put out a fire with gasoline. It doesn't work until I lay it all aside and follow what Chuck C., who's one of my great hero of mine, says, and I quit worrying so much about me being all right in my butt, and I start being more concerned with trying to help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to. And when I walk that way, I find out all sorts of things. Find out God is so much better lawyer than I am. If I go down to that law office, and I work hard, and I try to win cases, and make money, and look good, and cover my butt, I wind up in the snake pit every single time. But when I'm able to go down to that office and try to help God's kids do what they need to have done, for free and for fun, because I want to, I wind up making more money than I need. I wind up with young lawyers standing in line wanting to try a case with me. And I can sit down and tell them what I'm doing. And like Chuck said, they don't believe it. They think I've got some trick in the courtroom. They don't understand that I've just learned that the quiet, loving truth is the most powerful force on earth, in or out of a courtroom. They don't understand. But when I'm able to do that, God is so much better lawyer than I am. I'm not going to stay up here much longer, but I do want to tell you this. I have stumbled for the last, 24, 25 years, trying to one step at a time take that next stitch where the spark of divine tells me, rather than trying to figure out with my brain where I need to go. I have done it so poorly. I've done it so poorly that I don't think there's been one single day since May of 1990 that if you'd asked me, Don, have you done 6 and 7 well enough that it'll do any good today, that I would have said, yeah, I think I nailed it today. I would have said things like, no, man, I got knocked over by self-will 50 to 100 times. I'd take a couple of steps in the right direction, and then I'd get knocked over by selfishness and self-will, and I'd have to dust myself off and get up and say, Mom, Dad, I'm sorry, I fouled up again. And I'd stumble another couple of steps in the right direction, fall again. And I thought every time I fell, it was an interruption of my spiritual growth. But I understand now that that process is the only spiritual growth of which I'm capable. And my God seems to be just fine with it. My God doesn't require perfection from me. He or she doesn't even really require consistency. My God's fine with that persistence. And the bottom line on it is this, even though I felt like I was doing it so poorly, if in May of 1990, when I began this trek, God had told me to make a list of the best I thought I could have in every area of my life, and I had made that list, and God had said, I'm sick of your whining, I'm going to give it to you, I would have shortchanged myself in every single area of my life. When I'm willing to try to do what God wants me to do instead of what I think I need to do, God takes me to places that are absolutely unbelievable. My sweet wife Sharon and I have been married 24 years, and the only trick I used on Sharon was that old 11th step trick of, Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand Sharon rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood by her. And that will make you so attractive you can't believe it. It just absolutely nothing as attractive as spirituality, and that's the truth. And that sweet girl and I do not argue. I sponsor some counselors and psychologists, and they tell me it's not healthy to have a relationship where you don't argue. And I tell them that I'm just going to wall in my illness, thank you. They're welcome to their healthy relationship. And also, this is pure gift from God. It's not me, but if you or anybody else has caught me arguing with anybody in the last 25 years, somebody was paying me. I will not argue with you and make my belly hurt for nothing. It's just not that important that I establish to you that I'm right anymore, and I'm so grateful for that wonderful gift. The Bar Association, what they have done is just absolutely embarrassing. The forgiveness that non-alcoholics have for us and the acceptance that they have for us when we begin to try to do things right passes all understanding. In fact, it's not even fair. The poor schmuck that kept on doing the right thing day after day just quietly and never messed up doesn't get nearly as much attention as we do after we come back having destroyed everything around us. We come back, oh, I'm sure glad old Don's back, isn't he something? But that Bar Association that I did so bring into disrepute, as they call it, it wasn't a matter that people said, gee, whatever happened to Don Major? It's on the front page of the paper. They knew what happened to Don Major. And I didn't think I'd ever even get a law license back. And I didn't think that if I did, that I could practice law, practice criminal defense law, and live. I didn't think spirituality had anything to do with that. And I've already mentioned how wrong I was about that. God's the best criminal defense lawyer there is. God's an awfully good criminal defense lawyer. I'd been there a few years, and I got a call from a silk stocking firm. Many of you that are lawyers know what I mean by the silk stocking firms. And I looked at the call and said, God, what did they catch me doing? And I thought, I'm not doing anything. So I called them back. And they said, Don, we've got a vacancy on this committee over here that interviews these people that want to be judged to pass on whether they're qualified. And we really want you to come over here and sit on that. So they asked me to do that. And I did that for a couple of years. They said, let us make you chairman of this. And in every judicial election for a while I was chair, they put our picks of what we'd done to judge in the paper with my name there as chair. One year they called me and said, Don, please come to the bar dinner. We're giving you the award as the pro bono lawyer of the year. And that's for doing good things without being paid for them. And I assure you that the first 10 years I practiced, nobody thought about Don Major and pro bono in the same breath. And then I got a call and they said, come over here, Don. We want you to be a master at the end of court. We want you to sit here with these folks that are one tiny little step from the U.S. Supreme Court and the most powerful judges and lawyers in Kentucky. We really need a little tongue-chewing, drunk criminal defense lawyer that's destroyed everything in his life. And I've been blessed with sitting on that. And God has such a sense of humor. About 10 years ago, I was sitting in the barber chair and my cell phone rang. And it was the president of the state bar. And he said, Don, we've got a vacancy on the ethics committee. And just 2 years ago, they called me and said, you better make it to the bar dinner because we're giving you the big one. We're giving you the award for professionality and civility. And I want to tell you, you cannot get, in human terms, In human terms, you can't get there from where I was in April 1981. It's only God. What I did was destroy my life. All that other's gone. By the way, I used to never talk about that because I was afraid people would think I was bragging or not being humble or something. Some of my sponsees did an intervention and told me I had to talk to him. So if you got a problem with it, call me. I'm not me. And I love you folks, and thank you so much for letting me be part of it. God bless you.